The, is this policy or?
It's policy.
Okay, the Education Committee will come to order, and we have competition this morning. We have, the Finance Committee is meeting in room 23, and so we got, a number of our members are over there, and so they'll probably be going back and forth. But we'll catch a quorum here some, hopefully soon, and then we can take action on these bills. The first one is Senate File 11, which is Senator Saxhog. And this proposal relates to the online learning. And this, Senator Saxhog, you've pursued this issue with your local districts or district and for a number of years. So welcome, Senator Saxhog, and yes.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And you're right. It is one of those issues that probably two years ago or 3 years ago when we started on it, there wasn't as much of it going on online learning as there is now, and it wasn't as much of even a policy that, in fact, the governor is kind of pursuing now. So I think we're glad that we've done the work we have, and I'd like to thank you and the members for being here today. This is Senate File 11. And before I begin, I have an A3 delete all, but obviously we have to wait till we have a quorum to do that. But with your permission, when that comes about, I'd like to move that, and that's what we're going to be discussing off. So,
okay, Senator Saxhog, the A3 amendment is being handed out now.
Okay, great. Before, while that's being done, Mr. Chair. The bill that you now have before you, as I've said, is in its third year of work, and as we've been working on online learning in this state. And with me today are John Voss from the West Metro Intermediate School District at 287. He has 13 members. And Don Lang is superintendent for both Ely and International Falls School Districts. They've toiled long and hard, along with many other people, over the last couple of years to make sure that online providers and enrolling districts work together to better guarantee students receive the education that they expect and deserve. So I'm going to turn it over to these two gentlemen, and they're going to have some brief remarks, and then they'll go over that A3 amendment.
Okay, thank you, Senator Saxhog. Superintendent, or who? Superintendent Langan? If you can give your name for the record, please.
John Langan, Superintendent of Schools, International Falls, ISD 361, and Ely, ISD 696.
Please go ahead. Thank you.
Appreciate the opportunity, Mr. Chair, to try and lay, at least from a superintendent's perspective, what Senate File 11 represents. As Senator Saxhog has mentioned, this is the status right now of several years of discussion, deliberation, and very collegial argument, let me put it that way. The online learning phenomenon, if you will, that the country is experiencing certainly has not left Minnesota unimpacted. The traditional responses by superintendents, and I was certainly one of them, was a combination of, I don't understand it. I don't really know what good it's going to do for anybody. My job is to protect brick-and-mortar schools and my student ADM. And for about, I would say, a good year or two, that was my posture. What I think we all had to come to reconciliation with is the notion that online learning is indeed a valuable, effective, and efficient method. It's something we can put in our arsenal to aid students in learning. Once I think that decision was made, there became hope for all of us. So under no circumstances would I promote Senate File 11 as trying to put bulwarks or burdens regarding online learning. The
Can I just check in and wonder if finance?
Primary, if I may, and this is what I would close and hand it off to Dr. Voss. The primary importance of Senate File 11 is its effort to provide clear definition, clear statements of responsibility, clear procedures that would allow, require, direct school districts, online providers to work together for the benefit of the student and that student's online program. No longer can we hide behind notions of confusion or misinterpretation. And I think Senate File 11 does a good job in promoting that effort. This is now a collegial responsibility. And now that we've got our roles defined, I think that we're going to do a much better job with it. So I'm obviously very supportive of the amendment as you see it. Thank you.
Thank you, Superintendent Lyon. Maybe what we'll do is ask, is it Superintendent Voss?
No.
Okay. If somewhere along the line, if we could go through the amendment, and then I have a question as to how it relates to the governor's learning objective. So,
Mr. Chair, I think we're gonna do that immediately after Mr. Voss, as Dr. Voss has a couple of comments, and then
okay.
We need to do that. Yes.
All right, Dr. Voss, if you could give your name for the record.
Name is Jonathan Voss. I work with Intermediate District 287. I'm the supervisor for academic programs, which includes supervision of the Northern Star online program. And that includes not only the 13 members of Intermediate 287, but also is a consortium with the 11 districts in Northeast Metro Intermediate 916 and the Socrates Consortium in South Central Minnesota, plus St. Paul, Chaska, and International Falls. And so as we've worked with developing online learning programs, that's our main objective has been to include school districts in the planning and the delivery of online services. What we've seen statewide is a growth of about 50 to 80% per year in the numbers of students who are interested in enrolling in online classes. There's also been about 25 online learning providers that have been approved by the Department of Education. And so with some of the projections into the future, estimating that in the next 5 years, 50% of most students' work will be done with some kind of online computer-assisted instruction, the attempt here is to, as Dr. Langan emphasized, to provide clarity and consistency and good communication between the online programs and the schools. Because as students enroll, wading through the different procedures of all the different programs and their courses has become much more difficult than it was when there were only a couple of different providers to choose from. And so this bill and amendment are intended to streamline the communication process and make sure that everybody is well involved in the decisions about what students are doing.
Dr. Voss, you or Superintendent Langan want to start going over the A3 amendment?
I can
make a few comments. Okay. Dr. Voss?
Thank you. In the first changes to specify supplemental online learning as what is being discussed here in Subdivision 3. In the previous round of changes in 07, we defined supplemental and full-time online programs because there was some confusion over which particular rules applied to which. If a student is going to enroll full-time in an online program, that's generally governed by open enrollment statute. And so the enrollment procedures that we're dealing with here are only in regard to supplemental online when a student stays enrolled in their local district and only takes one or two classes online, transferring the credits back to their home district. The changes starting in line 1.22 are intended to provide a consistent means of informing the enrolling district of the course content and expectations, and also to establish a timeline in which the enrolling district replies to ensure that the courses are reviewed and that they'll meet the graduation requirements of the enrolling district. And again, this is just to clarify the procedures and also make it consistent among providers.
Now, in that one area, I think you mentioned that there's not only growth in your in the number of districts or courses that that your provider, right? Okay,
right.
But also there's a and I didn't catch the number of other providers that the department has.
About 25.
The courses that they're providing are, in a sense, screened by the department to either meet the, as spelled out here, the assessment requirements, the content, et cetera. One of the objectives in the governor's language was that it the online learning course had to meet, you know, the obviously the standards and everything, but also meets the college and career readiness standards. Now, how does that differ from the requirements that are currently being asked for? Senator Rummel.
I'm going to take a stab at that, Mr. Chair. I think the college and career ready would be those courses such as math, 4 years of language, physics, and science. Those are the kinds of courses you need to get into college.
Okay, so the governor's language doesn't necessarily spell out the criteria, but just spells out the general of courses.
I'm just guessing at
that. I see Superintendent Langan. Are you?
Mr. Chair, the comment that you received in terms of is this a is the governor's language specifying courses or is it identifying actual curricular disciplines? I think it's the latter.
Okay. All right. That could be wanted to see, you know, to see if those matched up. Okay. Dr. Voss?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In line 2.14, reporting of progress of online learners back to the enrolling district has been a particularly confusing issue, and I think one of the difficulties with communication by email and phone is that as easy as it is to do, it's also very easy to ignore. And so efforts to contact students sometimes are not successful, and the enrolling districts are definitely wanting to know how students are doing and needing to know if students are still making progress, because that impacts everything from truancy reporting to eligibility for athletics and other extracurricular activities. And so the intent here is to establish consistency in the reporting of student progress so that the enrolling district is fully aware of students, especially if they're not meeting requirements for progress. And one of the things that we would also like to add is that there be a contact person to assist in the facilitation and monitoring of student progress in the enrolling district. That's very clear that there is a role then for the enrolling district and that they're involved and responsible for student progress to the same extent as the online provider.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Scogin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Voss, on line 2.14, what do you see when you say must report or make available? Are you thinking something written, or is there an option here, or what do you see that line meaning?
There are a number of ways that that can take place, and I think the department will help to spell those out. What we have done is to give the contact person in the enrolling district access to the online course so that the counselor or whoever it is that's monitoring student progress can go right in and see exactly how they're doing, check the grade book, and check the activity level of the student. There's also ways that you can send midterm reports. Other programs give consistent two-week progress reports back on how students are doing. So there's a number of different ways that can take place.
Senator Salzman?
Yes. And on the same points, Mr. Chair, I guess a couple questions I have would first be is that if I understand this process right, if my child wants to take online learning, I would go out, fill out this application, notify my school district. They would look at it and determine if it has been an accepted, if it's a course that they accept, correct, at this point? Is that,
Dr.
I have
Ross.
It so far. Okay. So if a student decides to take three courses online, does the school district have the ability to work with that student to say, well, we'd like you to take those at school online? Is there any sort of release in here that a school district might say that if you're going to take the online courses, we'd like you to do it during the regular school day? Or does the student have flexibility that if they have a seven-period day, they would have to report to school for 4 hours and they could be released for three? Is there anything in there about that? And one of the things I just wanted to, I guess, check in is that I've heard rumors. I don't have documentation, but I've heard rumors that some of the concerns, I think, especially for Minneapolis, is that when students have been behind in coursework, they've sort of disappeared and gone into an online program and appear, you know, 3 weeks later and they've completed all their coursework. You know, that's probably an exaggeration, but that's the story I've heard. So I'm just wondering if in here if there's any sort of seat time requirement, because that is something that we've talked about in the governor's bill, that we're going from days of attendance to hours. And I think that's one of the questions is, can kids speed through an online course, and is there any requirements? I've asked a lot of questions. I'm just trying to understand how this might actually play out with the school district.
Dr. Voss.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Salzman, I'll try to back through those as best I can. There is no requirement for seat time in this particular bill, and we have avoided that because there are students for whom that would be a burden. And in particular circumstances, being able to do their work online is really the best way for them to complete their schooling. As far as whether they do it during the school day or outside of the school day, that decision is usually made between the local school and the student and the parent. And I think that's why we've got a consultation period built into this, so that we are sure we've got that communication. There is no one plan that fits all, and I think as we go forward with online learning, it's no longer a question of whether a student will be online or in the classroom. It's what combination of the two will work best for an individual student's circumstances. And as far as students who go and take courses and complete them quickly, there are circumstances where they can do that. The flexibility of online does allow you to focus very intently for the amount of time that you can put into it. As for the check on the validity of the credits, I think that's where we're looking at the syllabus to make sure that it includes all of the content areas that are required by the local school to grant that credit. The oversight of that, I guess, would then move to the department if there is a suspicion that something is being done in a course that was on the syllabus, coming back, and it does not appear that the student has either learned that material or even addressed it.
Mr. Chair?
Excuse me. Let the record reflect we had a quorum, and Senator Clark will be back. So, Senator Saxog moves the A3 amendment. which is the amendment that we're talking about right now. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted. Senator Sackler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Salzman, I think the underlying reason why this legislation came to the forefront was because of rigor. And that's kind of what you're really talking about is, you know, having three courses in 2 weeks or something like that. And so that's what we're really concerned about.
Okay. Any other comments, Dr. Voss or Senator Scogin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just it may pigtail onto what Senator Salzman was talking about too, but Dr. Voss, on 128 and 29, when we talk about expectations for actual teacher contact and student-to-teacher communication, is that something the department will determine in this legislation?
Dr. Voss?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Senator, thank you. The department will establish the guidelines for the syllabus, and it will be up to the program to define how they are providing for teacher contact time and student-to-teacher communication. And part of what is also included in Subdivision 7 at line 4.15 is that the provider will also give written assurance that all courses meet state standards, and that the curriculum instruction assessment and all of those teacher contact and communication issues meet nationally recognized professional standards, and that that's stated in the syllabus as well. So our intent is to, in addition to providing the information on the state academic standards that are covered, to also include information on how the programs operate in terms of delivery relative to national standards for online learning. That answer the question?
Senator Salzman?
Yes. And just another follow-up, Mr. Chair. I really support online learning. I think that there are incredible opportunities. And let me just ask if in this bill, it feels that this is a that this really addresses students who go out and seek opportunities. I just want to make sure that if a school district perhaps wants to offer Arabic and doesn't have a teacher, and if a school district wants to put in its curriculum, maybe when, you know, kids sign up, that some of their courses are partially online, is there anything in here that is going to make it harder for them to do that? Are they able to authorize that themselves, or do they have to go through the department to get that approved? Because I think that that's where I think there's tremendous opportunity for school districts, but that they might want students to take this course within school because they might be incorporating even science experiments or that kind of discussion. Is there anything in here that would prohibit them from having that kind of flexibility?
Superintendent Langan.
Mr. Chair, Senator Salzman, maybe I could respond to that. There is nothing in the bill that would preclude that. What I think, quite to the contrary, I think what the bill does, it enhances that potential to occur. When we first went into online learning, as I'm speaking now as a school superintendent, in many cases, the school district was brought in at the back end of a whole host of decisions that a parent, a provider, or a student had made. And we were not engaged in that process, but we were essentially handed a product. Now, do something with this. Those procedures now have just been reversed. I'll use International Falls as an example. I don't know whether Northern Star Online, which Dr. Voss mentioned is a consortium of participating districts, I don't know whether he could have gone any further to find another partner than International Falls. We have found that relationship with NSO to be a very rich relationship. And we work with our kids in identifying courses, opportunities through NSO that we can make available to the student. If NSO doesn't have the course, then I rely on Dr. Voss and his staff. Okay, where can I get it? So it's that type of an interaction. The majority of our students use online right now for credit recovery. However, I believe 2 years ago, I had a student complete advanced placement statistics through Northern Star Online as our provider. That opportunity would never have happened without this. So it does not preclude, it enhances that type of an operation.
Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you refresh my memory a little bit? How many students, or to what extent are students using online learning? I believe there are some students who can do their whole curriculum in online learning, but overall, what proportion of their curriculum or their stay in school might be done on online?
Dr. Voss?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rummel, there are students who do all of their work online. There are programs that operate as full-time online high schools and some that operate as full-time online K-12 schools. I don't have specific numbers, but I think the percentage statewide is somewhere around 10%, probably a little less than 10%. And again, I don't have them at my disposal, so I'm not entirely sure. The vast majority of students will take one or two classes online. We've had 1,500 individual course enrollments last year and this year, and there's probably about 700 students doing those. So most of those students are only taking one or two classes, either in addition to their regular schedule or as part of their regular schedule. But the number that I do know is that from the 07 school year to the FY08, there was around an 80% increase in the number of students who are taking something online. And I think that is where the growth is evident and likely to continue. And the projections are that that will continue to happen, especially as districts do develop their own programs and their own courses. There's any number of vendors now that districts can get online courses from and have them at their disposal within their district, and they oversee that themselves.
Senator Rummel.
And then as a follow-up, thank you, Mr. Chair, Superintendent, how does participation, if a lot of students are participating in online learning, does that affect the culture, the activity, or the way high school feels? Are we changing our high school significantly through online learning?
Superintendent Lyon?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rowe, are we changing the culture of the school through online learning and the whole digital enterprise? Yes, we are. I think that the changes I'm hoping will be evolutionary and in somewhat perhaps more of a controlled and intelligent manner than we may have done in the past. But the culture of the school will change. When will that hit a material level? I'm finishing my 29th year as a superintendent in your state, and I probably won't be around when that hits a materiality. But it is going to change. It's something that, quite frankly, I wished I had another 10 years left, because it's going to be exciting. And if I make one final comment on the culture of the school, it's going to change the culture of our profession. And I think the more that we can be sensitive to that, sensitive to an English teacher in the high school who's been teaching AP or Honors English for 25 years, it would be a huge waste to simply say, well, our older teachers simply will not become involved, and this will be left to the young lions coming in. We're doing everything we can to see that that doesn't happen. In fact, I can say that And in my situation, some of the more enthusiastic inquiries I've had in online learning from a pedagogical perspective is coming from my seasoned staff as much as from the young ones. And I find that very, very affirming.
Dr. Voss, if I just want to clarify from my own mind, the supplemental online program is for courses up to 50% of students enroll or courses?
Mr. Chair, the supplemental program is limited, or a student is limited to taking 50% of their courses that way without district approval. So a supplemental student can take all of their courses online and remain enrolled in their regular home district if the district approves of that. But most students will only take one or two courses.
And as long as they don't go over 50%, they don't have to have approval or anything.
Right. They do need approval of the courses that they meet their graduation requirements, but as far as being eligible to enroll, that's not limited.
And is the online learning provider, on your end of it as a provider, who interacts with the student? How is that handled? So let's say a student has a question about a particular issue. Does that student then email into the Academic Programs?
Mr. Terry, yes, there's a number of different ways students can communicate. The primary one is through the course management system. They can send a message to their teacher right within the online course. They can also email their teachers, and we have a technical support person, a counselor for other enrollment questions and general help with classes and life, and then registrar and other clerical staff to assist with the transferring of information. But most of the communication between the student and the teacher takes place through the online course or email or, if necessary, phone. And then we also have an interactive whiteboard chat program called Illuminate, which allows the student and the teacher to meet and talk to each other through the computer system and also to share information on the whiteboard, the computer screen. The teacher can type in information. And it can also incorporate video, so they can actually video conference if they both have that capability.
And is that the reason for the limit of 40 students per program?
Mr. Chair, I believe the 40-student limit was in the original law, and that was mostly to assure that there was a reasonable number of students that any teacher was handling at one time in one class. Most programs don't come anywhere near that. The maximum course enrollment is somewhere around 25, and in most cases more like 20.
Any Senator Saltzman?
So one of the things, Mr. Chair, that I'm not sure about and that it's not in this bill, but who pays for the online courses? If a student applies, and maybe I'm just missing something here, and that's another bill, obviously, but for a student who wants to take a supplemental course, and I think about students I know from, you know, my daughter's school, who wanted to take all, you know, wanted to be in choir and orchestra and take some of those classes, and so then they look to online to take math. Is that at their expense when they're going beyond their regular school day? Or if a student says, I want to take math online, and the school district offers it, does the school district, are they required to pay for that online course? So where does that fit in here? I know that's not part of this bill, but it would just be helpful to understand that.
Superintendent or...
Mr. Chair, Senator Salzman, the pupil unit gen ed formula is responsible for covering the expenses for a full-time student. And say, for example, I have a 7-period day in International Falls. a youngster can take seven courses that are to equate to of a maximum curricular day. If that youngster is taking four courses inside and then three courses outside, I pay for those courses as part of that pupil unit allocation behind the kid. If the youngster wants to take two more courses, and I'm going a little bit beyond where I should right now, but if there is not a at-risk denominator here, I believe the student would pay for those additional courses themselves. If it's an at-risk student, he can or she can take up to 0.2 additional pupil unit for credit recovery.
Okay, thank you.
All right, Senator Saxhog. I think there's any fiscal note, and I think everything's pretty well in order.
Well,
wait, I think we should check with the department. Is there, I believe the department wanted to some comment. Welcome, Mr. Brown.
Mr. Chairman, Morgan Brown with the Education Department. First, I just want to thank Senator Saxhog for his work on this legislation. I know he's worked very carefully with all the stakeholders involved, and I think really has come up with some good solutions to some of the practical concerns that school districts have had while making sure that there's also not any kind of unreasonable burden on either the students or the providers for students who want to take online courses. And as I look at the language, it's pretty much identical to the language that the department included in its bill as well. So we certainly support the bill and hope that it goes forward. Just to clarify a couple factual things that came up, in terms of current online learning providers that are certified, we currently have 20 certified online learning providers in the state. Six of those are charter schools, eight are individual school districts, and six are consortia of school districts, and that actually seems to be where the trend is going, is school districts partnering with other school districts, realizing that makes more sense in terms of economic efficiency for providing online courses. In terms of the number of students who currently are taking online learning from a certified provider, in last fiscal year, 08, we had a little over 8,000 students. About a little more than half of those were the supplemental students who were taking one or two courses mostly, and then a little less than half were actually students who were full-time online. Having said that, and as Dr. Voss noted, we've seen quite an increase in enrollment with certified providers. My guess is, although the district doesn't collect this information, but just anecdotally from talking to districts, my guess is this number is probably dwarfed by the number of students who are doing online learning or doing online courses within their own school districts, which, of course, districts can do on their own without any approval from the department. And one last clarification, just to make sure it was understood, when Senator Saltzman asked about who bears the cost for taking the online courses, the superintendent's answer was absolutely correct. And just to be clear about this, if the student was taking a full slate of courses either in a traditional brick-and-mortar setting or in a combination of the traditional setting and online and wanted to take an additional course beyond that full course load, then it would be the student that would have to pay the cost for the additional course beyond the full course load. It would only be the district and the state funding that would have to pay for it up to the full course load. So that's it, Mr. Chairman. I'm happy to take any other questions.
On page four, there's discussion or some language talking about the a challenge by an enrolling district. Would there be any change in the number of challenges that would occur under this legislation, or do you know?
Mr. Chairman, I don't foresee that necessarily happening. I mean, the challenge here pertains particularly to whether the course meets the requirements of the law. Under this language, as I understand it, and Senator Saxhog, if I'm not getting this right from your point of view, please correct me. Under the new language here, the district has discretion to say the course that the student is enrolling in doesn't meet that district's graduation standards, but that would not require the district to issue an official challenge with the state, because they weren't necessarily challenged whether the course or the provider had met the requirements of the statute. They're exercising their local authority to say whether the course meets their graduation requirements. So I'm not necessarily seeing that that would then result in a rapid uptick in official course challenges with the state in any case.
Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As long as we're on that, I'm just wondering, in a normal classroom, periodically somebody comes in and observes the classroom, sees what's going on, et cetera. Besides approving online coursework, what does the department do to a spot check, or maybe it's the school district's role to spot check how these courses are going, et cetera?
Mr. Chairman, Senator
Mr.
Rummel,
Brown.
There are kind of two answers to that. One is, online certified providers under the statute can only be school districts or charter schools, public schools that have certain accountability requirements anyway. And so certainly we have an expectation that school districts and charter schools that are offering online learning, whether they're doing that on a full-time basis or as a part of what they're providing, have responsibility to oversee the instruction for that course and check on that course just the way they would for any normal traditional brick-and-mortar course. Having said that, the state would certainly get involved and has gotten involved if we get a complaint about a certain aspect of what an online provider is doing, and we would certainly make an inquiry about that for a certified online provider because they have to go through that certification process. We obviously wouldn't do that in the case where it was just a local school district provide its own online course, because that would just be solely under the authority of that local school district and school board.
Okay. Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Superintendent, do you check in on these courses periodically? Do you observe? I don't know what the equivalent of observing would be in an online situation.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rummel,
Superintendent.
In terms of our involvement as a school district in the online life of a student in a course, how do we get in there? This past year, where we've been working to try and improve those processes, those reporting from the online provider back to the school district, we're right now using our guidance office. I can give you an example. If I have 20 students in credit recovery, they're taking an English course, a U.S. history course, whatever, the guidance office now at any point in time and go into that student's record with the student sitting right at the table with the guidance counselor, pull up the screen. This is where you're at in the course. This is where how many times you have logged in, how long you were there, what you did. And so you have actually a database in that dialogue session between a kid and a counselor that, quite frankly, is far more expansive than I've got with the other 1,000 kids. And are we trying to emulate part of the online experience in our regular face-to-face instruction? Yes, we are. So bottom line, in terms of monitoring, involvement, guiding, and directing, the data immediately available to accomplish that end with an online learner is probably stronger than what I've got with my brick-and-mortar kids.
Mr. Brown, in the governor's policy bill, you have an extension of the Online Learning Advisory Council from 2008 to 2013. Will the department book a cost for that extension? Where will that cost show up?
Mr. Chairman, thank you for that question. As some of the people around the table may remember, the Online Learning Advisory Council was something that was actually created by the legislature several years ago and then sunsetted last year. But the commissioner found it very helpful in terms of advising her on policy, especially in this new and growing area of public education. So we asked that it be recreated. The intent was to do it without a cost, and we will, when the policy book comes up, have to do ask someone to do an amendment to ensure that happens. And all the amendment would do in that part of the bill is it would delete a reference to another section of statute where if an advisory council is created under that section of statute, it does potentially generate both per diem and mileage costs for the members. And that was not our intent to create a cost for this council, so we will likely ask that one area be deleted so there would be no cost to the council meeting. That isn't to say that if the department was fortunate enough to the commissioner had some money that we wouldn't consider trying to reimburse mileage, especially for those folks that would travel from outstate, because we do want and have had representatives from rural areas on the council. It just wouldn't mandate that they had to be provided mileage if we didn't have funding to do so.
Okay. All right. Thank you. All right. Senator Saxog,
if there's
any other questions.
But if there's any other questions, if there is no other questions, Mr. Chair, I'd move that Senate File 11 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the floor.
Senator Saxog moves the A3 amendment Senate File 11 as amended to be recommended to be passed and sent to the floor. Any other discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you, Senator Saxog and Mr. Brown and Superintendent Langan and Dr. Voss. Thank you. Next we have Senator Osteen has been patiently waiting, and we have Senate File 33. Welcome, Senator Osteen.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I'm here before you with Senate File 33, and I have a couple testifiers, Mr. Schneiderwein from Minnesota School Board Association, and then Mr. Ving from the Minnesota School or the Academy for the Deaf. And Mr. Chair, this bill's had an interesting path. We passed a bill last year to address the Type 3 school buses, and it turned out that there was some different interpretation by the Department of Public Safety than my legislative intent. So we're basically back here doing some cleanups to the bill and also trying to put it in the making sure that legislative intent is clear in law. So so basically, the first part of the bill is there's some changes to driver's license that qualify for driving a Type 3 vehicle. First, I better mention what a Type 3 vehicle is. School buses are divided basically into five categories. There's A, B, C, and D, which an A is your typical, it's a van front with a school bus body. They're used a lot of times to transport handicapped students and may have a handicap lift and wheelchair accessibility. And then a B is kind of like a UPS van. You don't see many B. And then a C is conventional hood with a regular bus body behind it. And a D is a stub-nose bus with a flat front. And then a type C or type 3, excuse me, could be any kind of car, a van like a Suburban or a Dodge Caravan. Those are the Type 3 vehicles. And the problem with what happened, there was a young woman was being transported home to her home in Scandia and in a Type 3 vehicle, and the driver plowed into a school bus at 55 miles an hour, and he was killed, and Amanda Berglund was also killed. But it came about that he had marijuana in his system. And so as we started looking into this, and also in conjunction at the same time, the legislative auditor was looking at school bus transportation and had written a report addressing Type 3 vehicles. So these two things kind of came together at the same time. You could operate a Type 3 vehicle with the legal limit of alcohol in your system, and There was you weren't breaking any law. So clearly there had to be some things done. And I felt we did a good job last year with the bill, but we ran into some problems, and our testifiers are going to talk about the, I guess, the rule of unintended consequences, because I had no idea that the schools for the deaf were using their paras to transport their students, and a lot of times their paras or their instructors are also deaf, and so they would not qualify to operate a Type 3 vehicle under our previous law right now. So that was totally unintended, and it's an important part. We'll hear that testimony, how important it is for their drivers to be able to drive them around. Some of the other things, though, I guess the heart of the bill is that we had exempted teachers from the pre-employment drug and alcohol test and the physical, but I had used the word normal, and an attorney at DPS interpreted that if you're the golf coach and you normally drive the kids to the golf course, then your normal duties, so then you would need to have that drug test. And so we've heard, as the problems came to light with the bill, this summer we formed a working group with different transportation groups and school districts and the state patrol to try to find some solutions. And it's been an interesting, because we try some verbiage and that wouldn't work. So I think we've finally got it to the point where it's clear now, but it has been kind of a long road to get there. And we heard testimony where, like, some school districts might have 400 Type 3 drivers. Well, if they had to pay for a physical for 400 drivers that are occasionally driving the bus, because clearly if you're a Type 3 driver, then you do require the pre-employment physical and or the pre-employment drug test and the annual physical. So kind of with that, I'll briefly go over the changes to the bill. And the main change we're doing is that we're on line 317 or 319, we're saying that an employee of a school or school district who is not employed for the sole purpose of operating a Type 3 vehicle is exempt from paragraphs E and F. And E and F are the drug test and the pre-employment, or the pre-employment drug test and the physical. So if you're not hired as a Type 3 driver, then if you're the golf coach, the debate coach, somebody who's driving occasionally, then you will be exempt from a pre-employment drug test and the physical. But we have tightened it up a little bit, because now they're required to have an annual background check on their driver's license, which I think will be a very effective tool to if somebody has a DWI on their record or anything like that, that will show up. And then I need to address just briefly.
Can I just interrupt you for a second, Senator Osteen? Can you explain exactly what a pre-employment drug test is?
Yes. That means that before you're offered the employment, you go and you take a drug test and an alcohol test.
And what does that demonstrate?
Whether you have alcohol or drugs in your system. I'm a Class A driver, so I can drive anything except a bus. I don't have a bus endorsement. And so part of my job is I fall under the company has a random drug policy. So occasionally I will be the one that's the random person, so I will have to go and take a drug test. This is kind of similar to that. So before they're offered the position, they have to take a drug and alcohol test.
If I was smart, though, and I knew I was going to take a job that might require some driving, why would I not touch any drugs or alcohol before I started working? I mean, how from the point or the date of the test, how far back or how, you know, what would be the period of measurement that you could identify drugs or alcohol in your system?
Well, clearly, Mr. Chair, alcohol will pass through your system fairly quickly, but the drug will stay in your system, I think it's a matter of weeks. So I'll tell you, I worked at a shop where the mechanics were subject to drug and alcohol or drug tests, and there were a lot of people that filled out the application and walked out the door. So that's kind of, there's a part of our culture that that's part of their culture, and so they may just walk out the door. I think they'd be smart enough not to take the test, but
yeah, you'd think so. But Senator Clark,
Mr. Chair, kind of along those lines, I was also thinking, what if you know? So I'm now the coach of something, and I've been teaching for a long time. I never took a pre-employment test because that was long before, you know, they came after. So am I going to have to go take that, or is it sufficient that they're going to do a driver's license check?
Mr. Chair, Senator Clark, under the existing law today, unless we do these changes, and the interpretation from DPS would be that now you're changing, you're entering a new category. You've been a teacher for 20 years, but now you're becoming this coach. That's a new duty for you that you would have to take that. So that's one of the reasons that that I think we really need to change this.
Senator Clark.
Although, Mr. Chair and Senator Alcyon, under the changes that I just heard you describe, and I've been trying to kind of piece this together in the written part, is what would happen to me under, with your changes? If I'm not required to, which I think is fine, but if, because at some point it's like I keep thinking about the costs among other things. If it's now not considered a change for me, how does that make it any different for me than somebody else? Mightn't we just want to go ahead and do the background checks on the driver's licenses for anybody who starts doing the driving and leave it at that instead of requiring a pre-employment drug test? Because having, at least at one point in my life, worked with a number of people who had chemical dependency issues, I agree with what you said about people walking out, but a lot of times they will walk back in the door 3 or 4 weeks later and fill it out after they're clean. So there are ways of going around that. If what you're really trying to get at is that making sure that somebody doesn't have a DWI, doesn't have something, unless we're going to require random drug and alcohol tests for everybody who touches a car or a vehicle ever.
Mr. Chair, Senator Clark, really puts it more in line with the big buses for the people that are going to drive the Type 3 on a full-time basis, because if you're driving a regular school bus, I might have to turn to the State Patrol on this to make my facts correct here, but I believe that you are subject to a pre-employment or at least a drug test.
And I'm not trying to be difficult, but I thought what I partially just heard you say is this kind of plethora of people who might be 300 people in a school district and lots of people who are only doing this as part of their jobs. But I thought I heard you say that even if it's part of your jobs, I mean, you've got kind of two different groups of people, the people who this is going to be their primary job, and then there's the people who may do this occasionally. But it sounds like we're still going to expect that the people who do it occasionally are going to be subjected to the same requirements as the people who are going to primarily do that. And at least in my head, I was hearing you say some inconsistent things, requiring a pre drug screen for a new hire, but if I've been working for a long time, I won't have a drug screen under the changes. And maybe I'm just misunderstanding you. I'm just trying to get a better sense of what the level we're really expecting, given we've got two very different kinds of people driving these vehicles.
Mr. Chair, Senator Clark, I think that's pretty good interpretation that there are two levels. There's the people that drive these every day. They're going to be a full-time Type 3 driver. And then there's the drivers that drive for the debate team. Under current law, that from the changes we did last year, the interpretation would be that that's a duty change, that would trigger a pre-employment or a drug test because they're starting a new duty.
And with your new change, I just want to know what the changes would be.
Okay, Madam Chair, or Mr. Chair and Senator Clark, the new changes would be that if you're not hired solely as a Type 3 driver, you'd be exempt from the drug and alcohol test and the physical. So we're exempting the occasional driver from those two. But they are subject to a background check, annual background check.
They are subject. Everyone would be caught in a background check. And
correct.
The other thing would be the new language on 2.21 must comply with the employer's policy. And I am assuming that the employer's policy would deal with the background check would probably pick up any unusual kinds of occurrences. Senator Clark?
Mr. Chair, this, I guess, in a way, kind of goes back to your original question. We're still, at least the way I'm reading this language, if you're new, you're going to require a pre-employment drug check even if this is only part of your job, or if it is fully or solely your job? That's because a part of my concern is that we'd be treating people differently. I mean, what is it we're really trying to get at with the pre? I'm not against those. They can be very good tools. But if we're saying, if I've just, we're just going to trust that I'm fine because I've been working for the district for a while, oh, that says one thing. I'm not sure that that's a good gauge. I think the person who was caught with the having used marijuana, probably nobody would have believed they were using marijuana and driving. So maybe that's not a good gauge. But if we're saying somebody new that's coming in, that everybody new has to have this, what's the difference between the new people and the people that have been employed for a while? I'm not sure, given what you're trying to do, that there's a big difference. The background check makes lots of sense to me, but I'm just not sure why we're making new people go through the pre-employment drug screen and not other people, or vice versa.
Mr. Chair, Senator Clark, I think I could address it pretty well by just saying that when you're hired as a Type 3 driver, you're out driving all day. There's no supervisor seeing you. You're driving that vehicle with students in it. If you're the math lead coach, you're probably a math teacher. So you're in the school. People are observing you. You're driving the kids to the math event, and you're driving them back. That's the difference. When you're a driver, you're on your own. And so there's not a level of supervision.
So, Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, I think what I'm hearing you say is if I'm hired primarily as a teacher, but I'm going to also be the debate coach, I fall under the exception, so I will not have to do the pre-screening for this purposes. I may have to under other parts of the manual. Is that correct? But if I'm hired to be a Type 3 driver, I do need to do this. That distinction makes sense to me.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you. Let's hear from some of your testifiers.
Well, this will be very interesting testimony, so pay attention, please. I'll turn it over to this is quite a compelling story.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Sean Vernig. I'm a licensed educational administrator and interim student life director at the Minnesota State Academy for the Deaf. It was established in 1863. The MSED is a dual accredited statewide public school that provides standards-based education and related services to students 0 through 21 who are deaf and hard of hearing. Thank you so much for this opportunity to testify in support of Senate File 33. I would like to focus on several key points about the proposed exemption that will allow our qualified staff who are deaf and hard of hearing to drive the students again. The mission of the MSAD is to promote the highest level of self-sufficiency possible for deaf and hard of hearing students. Getting a driver's license, too, is a rite of passage for our students towards self-sufficiency. However, without the exemption, our driver education instructor, who is deaf, is unable to fulfill his responsibilities as a qualified instructor. This then prevents students who are deaf or hard of hearing from having the same opportunities as their hearing peers. The educational process at the MSAD is provided in an environment where direct communication access is available to all students at all times. Recently, my staff, who is deaf, had to drive himself while his hearing colleagues drove our students to a traditional off-campus gathering. Suffice it to say, this was demoralizing and awkward for this loyal state employee, who is deaf, the hearing colleagues, and even the students. Federal law mandates that services provided by the MSAD must meet the student's need for a free and appropriate public education, FAPE, within the least restrictive environment. Our work-study program has been struggling to comply with this mandate so that our students can hold their jobs in the community. There are many other instances where the FAPE for our students were potentially compromised due to unintended, unforeseen logistical challenges. This is not all about our staff members who are deaf and hard of hearing, but also our hearing staff. They too have been burdened with additional duties, responsibilities, and accountabilities. To illustrate, I would like to read a statement shared with me by hearing staff at MSAD. For our staff who are hearing, the law as is has been a huge time consumer. I had to go get a DOT physical, and I'm still waiting for reimbursement. This involved 2 trips to the clinic. I have to drive a student almost every day to and from her gymnastics class in the community. In addition to this, I'm often asked to transport students to various events and establishments in Faribault. This greatly consumes my time. I find that I barely have time to catch my breath. Or to complete my daily work tasks. It's very tiring to do this on a daily basis. I've also transported students to and from sporting events. In the past, the MSA athletic director, who is deaf, and coaches, who are also deaf, could transport students. Often now, I'm the only one in my area who deals with specific phone calls, and then there are parents or others who become frustrated when I'm not receiving their phone calls or attending to student needs and issues. I find this to be extremely taxing. On top of all this, I have to check the engine, the tires, the lights, and so on to fill out a form stating that the vehicle is fit for transporting students. Please support Senate File 33. Before last year's bill was passed, qualified academy staff who are deaf and hard of hearing transported students safely to educational and co-curricular activities and field trips. Please revise this law and let our staff who are deaf and hard of hearing do the jobs for which they are already qualified. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, if there's any questions for the witness, I'm sure you'd be happy to answer them. But he did bring up a point that I'd like to follow up on, and that is that we do have a pre-trip inspection sheet. And it was kind of a Rube Goldberg because this thing, when we do a DOT physical where I work, I mean, we got a four-page form that we fill out, and this was kind of what it was being used. And I have to compliment Lieutenant Carroll sitting against the wall here from the State Patrol for simplifying the form so it's simply a visual check. You know, you walk around, make sure the tires aren't flat. You look under the hood and see if there's, you know, windshield washer fluid in the tank. And so check the lights and the brakes and just step on the brake. You know, so we're very clear that we've simplified this form. And it's almost like a form you might do when you rent a car or something. So that's been a positive change. We're not putting that in law. The State Patrol has just done that and put it on their website as a model form. So that was – and now, Mr. Scheidewin, if you want to
– Sure, absolutely. Mr. Chair, my name is Kirk Stein, and I'm on staff with the Minnesota School Boards Association. And I'd just like to thank Senator Olstein. I think we all left the end of last session walking away feeling like we had agreed on some language that we understood. And as the summer rolled along, I think there more questions were raised and more confusion about what exactly was meant. And I think over the interim, we've worked with a number of groups, including Senator Olstein, who's been great to work with and trying to fix this problem. And I think the language before you provides that fix and provides school districts the flexibility while not compromising student safety. And I think that's an important piece for all school districts to understand. And I think that we started to see some districts being very creative trying to get around this proposal where they just said, well, we're not going to require all our employees to do physical examinations. We're going to start in kind of a creative way. We're going to use public transportation as a mode to get students from the high school down to the Kiwanis Club or whatever it might be that they may visit. And so this clarifies that those employees who only drive on a part-time or limited basis would be exempt from those two pieces. And that's where we heard the largest complaints. We heard districts who were paying $150 to $180 for physical examinations, and they were unsure if they were only going to target their employees who may drive or they needed to do the entire staff. And so there were some it was all over the map. Some targeted, some said, no, everybody's going to do this. And so we think that this fix provides a solution for our districts and provides the flexibility that our districts are looking for. And I will stand for questions, sir.
Mr. Schreiderwin, could you just touch on the what would be a normal language in a policy, a district's policy regarding the language on 2.21, and I know every district may be different, but for the MSBA, they generally have some guidance in terms of here's a policy that you can put in your policy book, and so I assume that a lot of it's going to be the same.
Right, and I think, and I, Mr. Chair, and I think you're accurate. I think the issue before, I think there's the federal drug testing requirement that's incorporated within larger policy. I think there's nothing right now that would prevent a school district from going beyond that right now in this, go beyond this, and drug test every one of their teachers, employees, if they so chose. Now, with that comes some additional requirements for the districts and employees, and that would have to be discussed at the local level. But I think what we've seen is, you know, that we know some districts do this. They think it's a good practice. We know the intermediate school districts, this issue has been raised to them, and as a result, what they're going to do now is, and they have a lot more full-time drivers than regular school districts do, and they've just decided that, well, if it's good for them, then we're going to make that decision here at the local level to do a drug test on these students who are on these employees who may be driving on a limited basis.
Good. All right. Thank you. Any other questions? All right.
We have some other testimony from Education Minnesota.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Jody Boer with Education Minnesota, and I'll be brief. I just want to echo some of the remarks that have been made. We support this bill, and I, too, and on behalf of Education Minnesota, would like to thank Senator Olsen and others for the work that they've done on this bill. Another scenario that we had heard about was with our paras, who many times if there was a student that was sick in the school and the parent or guardian for a number of reasons couldn't get there to pick the child up, the para would obviously drive the child home. And so we believe that they don't fall under the requirements, and we believe this bill fixes the unintended consequences and while still protecting our students, which is our highest priority. So we fully support the bill, and again, just want to thank you for your work on this. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Hey, thank you.
And then Mary Hartnett would like to speak also.
All right. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mary Hartnett. I'm the Executive Director of the Commission of Deaf, Deafblind, and Hard of Hearing Minnesotans. I just wanted to add a little bit to Sean Vernick's testimony. The unintended consequences you heard of last year's bill was the requirement of because of the requirement that was put into statute of a physical, which also included the requirement to pass a hearing test. All staff who are deaf were unable to drive Type 3 vehicles. That means that Mr. Vernick was unable to drive a student to this event. I mean, he's perfectly qualified, and he would have been able to do it before, but now he was unable to do it. We had a student who's been giving very compelling testimony, Allison Porter, who's come to just about every hearing. The MCAs are being administered today, so she was unable to be here. So I just wanted to say some of the things that she said in her testimony that I thought were really important. And one was just as far, it's been very demeaning for the staff. It's been demeaning for the students to see their deaf staff, their deaf role models, deaf professionals unable to drive. Their sports events have been canceled. Their school activities have been canceled because they don't have drivers. They were hoping for a quick passage of this bill so spring sports and spring activities would be able to continue. So with that, I just wanted to summarize in very briefly what Allison would have said. Unfortunately, she can't be here, and she really wanted to be. So thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hartman. I appreciate the information, and hopefully this has gone through the Judiciary Committee, and it's gone through the Transportation Committee, and now hopefully we'll take action, and I think it'll be sent to the floor. So, Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Senator Olsen, and I appreciate your work on this, and I think you've done a great job. I know last year when we worked on this in your subcommittee, and then also with the legislative auditor's report, and it's just I want to make it very clear to the committee that as we talked about this issue, it was our intention, I think the intention of everyone involved in that discussion, not to create an undue burden on teaching staff and others and interrupt the sort of existing practices of allowing for occasional transportation of students. And that was never the intention, and we thought we had language that would accommodate that. Obviously, it was interpreted in other ways. And so I think that this is a good thing to do to clarify that, and hopefully that this will then solve that problem. We had never had in our mind, I think, ever the intention of trying to create this mechanism that would involve additional cost and burden and make it difficult to do things that are currently being done very successfully. And some of the testimony we had makes it very clear that our transportation of students in Minnesota is very, very good. We have very, very low accident rates, very low injury rates, and we have a very safe system, and this does nothing to impede that that safety. So appreciate your work on this, Senator Lucia.
Thank you, Senator Hahn. Any other questions or anyone else that wants to testify on this?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Saxon?
I would move that Senate File 33 be passed and sent to the floor.
Mm-hmm. Senator Saxog moves that Senate File 33, and I don't believe there are any amendments, be moved and recommended be passed and sent to the floor. Any other discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted. Thank you, Senator Osteen, and all of those that you had testify.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
And the last bill is Senate File 358, Senator Dahl. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Senator Dahl.
In front of you, Senate File 358, and colleague just said to me, "This should be fun." I actually hope it's not that fun. I hope it is fun. I really have. This is a resolution. I want to be very clear about that. That quite simply says that we should not reauthorize the No Child Left Behind Act in its current form. So that's I really want to make that distinction, that in its current form, I think there's flaws. And again, this resolution just asks Congress, I know they're busy with many things, not to forget education and some of the flaws in the No Child Left Behind Act. I'll briefly just touch on a few of the whereases and the resolved statements. But again, the No Child Left Behind has established in 2002, bringing academic achievement in language arts, math, science, who are not achieving at acceptable levels. The No Child Left Behind Act, as it was drafted in 2002, was an opportunity for change, and by reauthorizing that, we hope that the reform comes. We have some concerns about the funding levels, the financial costs of some of the unfunded mandates, some of the sanctions that for schools that are not making average yearly progress, and the fact that schools have to target additional resources we think are unreasonable. We hope that any assumptions surrounding No Child Left Behind are based on sound research and student achievement, effective teaching. Again, addressing the AYP, that some of those are unattainable, especially 100% student proficiency on tests and mathematics, reading, language. Also concerns about the federal government's role in a function that's generally left to the states, over-reliance on standardized testing, and again, the students to be 100% proficient by 2013-2014, we think that may be unreasonable, especially for students with disabilities, and of course, the accountability for Title I funds and some of the concerns there. So, be it resolved that the state of Minnesota would urge Congress to repeal the No Child Left Behind Act if the aforementioned concerns go unaddressed. We as a state want to continue to work toward the goal of closing the achievement gap without the coercion of losing federal funds. And so we ask that Congress, in a timely fashion, address those concerns. So again, quite simply, a resolution. I don't see Dr. Charlie Kite here, but he is his association, the MASA Superintendents Association, has a similar resolution that they have distributed, and they have over 80 schools. They have similar whereases, but their final resolved statement says something to the effect that we urge the Minnesota legislature and the governor to inform the federal government of Minnesota's intent to consider withdrawal from participation in the No Child Left Behind if a repeal or reframing of the statute is not completed by October of 2010, and be it resolved that the Minnesota legislature and the Minnesota Department of Education develop a more positive approach to state efforts to raise student achievement for both students and for schools. So again, already 80 schools have signed on a resolution that has a lot of similarities to the one that I'm put before you. Also like to remind you, I believe it was Senator Michelle had a bill on the floor last year, or an amendment that advocated that we get out of No Child Left Behind, and that was still with money attached. This obviously wouldn't affect the funding that would come to us, but that was actually a very close vote on the Senate floor, so I don't think I'm treading into new ground. That's the resolution. I don't have any testifiers on my own behalf unless there's some on the committee. I'm glad to answer any questions.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dahl, when you the No Child Left Behind Act is the name that is currently given to the Elementary Secondary Education Act, which encompasses Title I and all of those. There's other funding streams in addition to the wrinkles that involve the accountability and measurement of achievement. So when you suggest that if they don't, that they repeal it, are you suggesting that they repeal their entire, that's kind of the instrument of federal involvement in education? Tell them to get out of it altogether and we'll take care of it ourselves, just spend money, or what do you, what's your intent in that? Because that's one of our challenges that we've, every year that we have considered not participating, is that with it would go the state's share of Title I and some of the other funds within that act. So I wonder if you want to have quite that strong. I'm not suggesting them against a lot of the intent of what you're saying, but that's a pretty strong statement. And do you really mean it?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I am referring, I think, mostly to the No Child Left Behind provisions. I think the ESEA has been around a lot longer than since before 2002.
But Mr. Chairman, every president puts their own title to it. It's been known as other. It's had other titles along the way, but it is the framework of the Elementary Secondary Education Act, to which this name has been applied, and some of the policy changes that have worked with Will along the way. So, if No Child Left Behind Act is the name for the Elementary Secondary Education Act now. It's not for just those provisions.
Senator Dahl.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, and not my intent to totally bow out of the ESEA as we know it, but I've addressed some of the concerns in the resolution as it pertains to the current law and the reauthorization coming up. So, I note your concerns, but I'll leave it at that.
Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Dahl, I'm wondering if it might, I think certainly there's going to be major changes to that policy. Whether or not it will be complete by October 10th of 2010, or whatever date you put in here, I'm not sure. Might we ask for a waiver from the NCLB requirements until it's checked or it's changed?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dahl.
I don't believe there's a date in my bill. I referenced the resolution put out by the Minnesota Association of Superintendents, so I don't believe I have a date certain of October. That was the MASA resolution.
Okay. Thank you.
It seems like the direction the new administration might be pursuing is a couple that I can think of. One is there's going to be increased funding from the federal government Now, how much and in what areas, I suppose we'll have to wait to see. But then it sounds as if there might be increased requirements as well. At least usually if there's going to be additional dollars, there's usually some strings attached. And I yesterday there was a proposal that President Obama had put out that went along the lines of the increased dollars for funding, but there were going to be, you know, high-stakes testing, longer school year, the ability to try to instill performance pay or performance some kind of like merit pay, and then also to try to get at, I think I don't think in his speech there was a mention of necessarily the achievement gap, but I think the way he defined it basically was to try to raise everything up, which would, I think, address the achievement gap, but basically get us back, or the United States educational system back on a track of a higher performance and more diligence toward the education achievement end of it when you kind of compare us. And I don't think he was comparing us to certain countries, but I think that was kind of the general approach. So in light of that, how does the resolution fit in? We're not saying, by passing this, we're not saying we don't want high stakes or high achievement, or we're not saying we don't want your money. I think that was one of the issues with the original NCLB, was that they didn't fund it or fund it adequately. Senator Bonner?
Mr. Chair, I wonder along those lines, too, if we aren't premature in offering the resolution, because it seems that President Obama is taking a pretty strong leadership stance with regard to education, and so I'm interested to seeing how that plays out. And I was talking to the commissioner before I came in here, and she just got back from Washington. She was meeting with the new, Secretary Duncan, and she said that they were in a room all talking about the different challenges they were facing, and that all of a sudden there was a lot of security around, and she wondered what was going on, and there was the president, and that the president addressed them for quite some time and shared, how important education was and what a priority that was going to be. And I've also, as I read his remarks yesterday, I didn't hear them, but I thought I read his commitment to early education. Yes. And that was going to also be a key focus. So I would hate for us as a state to send a signal saying you're going on the wrong direction when he's just beginning his administration and we haven't given this administration a chance to display the direction they're going.
Senator Michelle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate Senator Dahl bringing this forward. And I guess in a slight contrast to my esteemed colleague from Minnetonka, I think part of the discussion we need to have at this table and in this building is, regardless of who is the president and regardless of who is the governor or the commissioner, is this the level of government that we want doing more and paying more and requiring more of our schools? And I get worried that we are going to get lured into this because of money, especially in this kind of an economy, that the temptation of federal dollars will make us look the other way when we know that the people who know best about our kids, about our school children, our teachers, and local school boards. So I think that's the, and there's no magic answer to that, Mr. Chair, but that's the tension here.
Senator Dahl and then Senator Haynes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think by passing this resolution, we are not sending a message to the president that we're going in the wrong direction. What this bill does is, here's where we've been in the past since 2002, and here are some of the concerns as you consider going forward and you develop your own education policy, which I'd like to see more of, and I'm confident he'll go in the right direction, but here are the concerns that we have in its existing form, and whether it be unfunded mandates or AYP that's unreasonable or too much standardized testing or not dealing with students with disabilities, I think going forward, let's address some of those issues.
Senator Saltzman before Senator Hamm.
And on the same points, Mr. Chair, I guess I kind of agree with, you know, everything that's been said here, but I do think it's important for us to send a message from Minnesota in that we hear a lot of times people talking about, oh, like we start to wring our hands, this isn't working, and I think it's important for us to send a message that what has been in place has been a problem. And that I think this encourages the president and those on the federal level to sign to hear from the front line. And I think that that's one thing that we try to do. That's where we get, I think, in trouble around here is when we don't acknowledge what is happening on the front line in our schools. And I think our federal government is even more removed from that. And that's, I think, the frustration we heard even when the federal stimulus package came out. I looked around the table and I saw a lot of people very concerned that some of the things that we would like to do in Minnesota that we think is very important in terms of prevention, we felt at the time, and I know that, you know, the information continues to come out on that, but they weren't really funding the programs that we're seeing here are really working and making a difference. So I think it's important that we send a message that what has been in place has been a concern. I don't think anyone's concerned about accountability. I think schools welcome it as long as we don't tie their hands and tell them we want you to be accountable, but then here's how you have to do it. And I think that's the frustration with some of these things. So flexibility, I think, is important, and I think that this is a good starting point for that discussion.
Senator Hamm.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Senator Dahl. I appreciate your bringing your resolution, and I do support it, maybe not as wholeheartedly as if it were written a little bit differently, but I think that the point is, and I think Senator Michelle makes that point as well, there is no constitutional mandate authorization for the federal government to do anything in education. The fact that we've been doing it for 40 years and we spent hundreds of billions of dollars, all of it directed from the start to close the achievement gap, of which there's no evidence that that has occurred. It doesn't matter who the president is, doesn't matter who the commissioner is, doesn't matter, you know, whether we may like or not like some of the policies the federal government advances. The point is that it shouldn't be done. And I don't have confidence that the president, even if he likes early childhood or he likes vouchers or he likes merit pay or whatever he may prefer, it is not the duty of the federal government to be doing this. And we shouldn't take the money. I think Senator Michelle is right, that we are being tempted to do things for money. And there's a word that describes that behavior. And I don't think we ought to get into that position of putting ourselves into that role. And so I support your resolution because I think it does say we shouldn't accept the constraints that the federal government is putting on us. I think it does raise the question of the money. They won't give the money without some constraint. There were people when NCLB was putting forth that liked some of the things that the NCLB constraints were, and some people supported on that basis. And I suspect when it gets reauthorized under President Obama, people who may not have liked NCLB will like the new constraints better, but they still will be there. And the real question is whether or not we as a state are the people that should be making those decisions, and I think we should. And I think this does send that message, and I would just encourage us going forward not to get tempted by the money and say, well, we like this particular federal policy, so we'll take the money anyway. We ought to say no, and we ought to be very clear about that. So I support your resolution. I wish we would make that point a little more clearly, but I think it can be inferred.
Okay, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Senator Hand. I think that, I agree with you that the federal government shouldn't be in the education business, and it looks like it will be going further. In fact, I think if I read correctly, I just scanned that article in today's paper. One of the things is that the president is recommending is standardizing curriculum and objectives, and so making that a national endeavor. Because one thing that the No Child Left Behind approach did was states set their own standards, and they also developed their own assessment measures for those standards. And yet, you know, had to meet what we said we were going to do in order to do it. That acknowledgement isn't clear in your resolution. I think it would be more straightforward if the state really wants to get out of it to have a resolution that we would do that. And I think that has been attempted before, which always has the handicap is that where do we get the money that we end up losing, because we are already hooked on it. And that's the difficult part of it. But I think there's some good points have been made in terms of the timing of this, because you know, we know that there's going to be changes to it, and communicating the nature of those changes, I think, is appropriate, the ones that we would support. But we ought to be paying attention, too, to what the president is saying and offering our perspective on those issues with it, too. So I'm a bit uncomfortable in the way that it's in the way that it's structured right now, but I do appreciate your intent and your frustration, because I think we've all experienced that.
Okay, Senator Bonner.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Dahl, I have swayed my views listening to my colleagues, and so I see the benefit of going forward with the resolution.
Thank you, Senator Wieger.
Yes, me too. But I had a similar resolution a few years ago, and I think it's important every year or two that we weigh in on these federal issues, because the majority of what we're talking about relates to this federal expectation. And at the same time, I think it would be very helpful if we had maybe after the session a joint meeting with our colleagues in the House and invite our congressional delegation. Congresswoman McCollum did meet with us, and actually it was a hearing that she had it with our committee, but we could get some others, and I would make that suggestion as well.
Okay. Senator Michelle.
Well, I'm afraid to ask, Mr. Chair, but what do you think they do with this resolution when we send it to Washington?
It's my understanding that it's air expressed out to D.C. and then dropped right on the Capitol.
Mr. Chair, Senator Wieger, did you get a reply? Thanks for the letter. Or?
Mr. Chair, Senator Michelle, yes, we did get very nice responses, and
nice.
They were signed.
Maybe a flag from the U.S. Capitol.
Senator Dahl.
What was the shape of the flag?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's actually framed in one of the bathrooms in the Capitol building. The fact that I've heard comments and support from both sides of the aisle here, and the comments that I've agreed with, again, I think shows that there's, you know, a general concern about the direction that we are going from the federal level in education. So I appreciate the comments and the support for this. I then move Senate File 358.
Senator Dahl moves Senate File 358. Is there anyone else that wants to testify on this? And this will go to the floor. Okay, please give your names for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jan Olswager, Education Minnesota. We would just go on record saying that we support Senator Dahl's efforts related to No Child Left Behind. It is our position that No Child Left Behind should first be fixed and funded, and I believe his bill does that. And in the event that that can't be done, that we need to examine even having No Child Left Behind. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Olswager. Yes.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jesse Montagna. I'm with the Department of Education. Mr. Chairman and some of the members here, as you know, I have been around for quite some time. I probably have a lot of institutional memory. And working with the type of student that No Child Left Behind is about, and that is your low-income student, your student that is more likely not to achieve academically. The type of student that is an English language learner, your migrant education student, that's been my career in the classroom as well as a department. While I'm not here to say that No Child Left Behind is perfect, I can tell you that in all my years, and I'm not sure I want to tell you how long that's been, but a long time, this legislation has done more to bring to the forefront the fact that these were the students who were not achieving for various reasons. In our own state, I would visit schools and I would see that the expectations for these students would be set much lower, the notion being they can't learn. I would walk into a classroom and see a seventh grade student being handed an inappropriate curriculum material, such as a first grade reading book. Not appropriate. Again, while this is not a perfect bill, the students that this bill is designed to address are the students that are growing the fastest in our own state. Our student enrollment is declining, but these students are the ones who are increasing. So while I encourage you to consider this very carefully, there are areas which I'm hoping that in reauthorization will be addressed. I do believe in accountability, and until we did have accountability, nobody could tell you how these students were doing and that we had a very significant achievement gap in our state.
Thank you, Ms. Montana. Okay, on anyone else? On Senator Dahl's motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted. And members, before we adjourn, tomorrow we have Senator Scogin has a referendum bill, and Senator Saltzman has a reading corps bill that we'll take up. So, committee is adjourned.
You are bad.
All right.